This is Stacey Lane Wilson, and you are listening to Rock is Lit. Lucky you.
Rock is lit.
Rock is lit.
Rock is lit.
Rock is lit.
You're listening to Rock is Lit with Christy Halberg. Rock on, Christy.
Is lit.
Hey, lit listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Rock is Lit, the first and still only podcast devoted to rock novels, and also the 2024 American Writing Awards Podcast of the Year in the categories of music and arts. Rock is Lit is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Jimmy Kimmel, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Rock is Lit is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Christy Alexander Halberg, author of my own rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. Special shout out to this semester's Rock is Lit interns, production intern Cater Jones, and social media intern Jenna Rudolph. Find out more about me and Rock is Lit on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Christy Halberg. Visit my website at ChristyAlexanderHalberg.com. And for goodness sakes, subscribe, comment, leave a 5-star rating and all that good stuff on your podcast platform of choice. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show starts in 3, 2, 1.
It may not be Halloween, but we're getting our spooky groove on in this episode. Stacey Lane Wilson joins me to talk about the fourth novel in her Immortal Confessions vampire series, Rhapsody in Red. Variety labels Stacey's work as Headbanger's Ball meets Tales from the Crypt, and calls it perfect entertainment for anyone who's ever played Stairway to Heaven backward to hear the mumbled phrase, "Here's to my sweet Satan." We'll also talk about Stacey's upbringing in 1970s and 80s Hollywood as the daughter of music legend Don Wilson of the Ventures and pin-up model, actress, and author Nancy Bacon, and more, including Stacey's wicked cool podcast and book series, Rock and Roll Nightmares. But first, Rhapsody in Red. Rhapsody in Red immerses readers in the glamorous yet sinister world of 1970s Hollywood, where vampires Ashara Conrad and Liam Archer reign supreme. Ashara, a nightlife photographer capturing the essence of the Sunset Strip, and Liam, the frontman of rising rock band Dark Horse, are an inseparable couple, until one fateful Halloween night. While Ashara is lured to an intriguing party, Liam finds himself obligated to co-DJ at a radio station. As the night unfolds, Ashara becomes embroiled in a chilling scavenger hunt at an isolated castle, where she encounters other paranormal beings armed with deadly weapons and tasked with a sinister mission. Meanwhile, Liam and sultry DJ Loretta entertain listeners at the radio station, where the atmosphere crackles with hidden dangers. Rhapsody in Red blends humor, sensuality, and suspense, offering readers a tantalizing mix of rock music, murder mysteries, and demonic intrigue. Whether enjoyed as a standalone or as part of Stacey's Immortal Confessions series, this novel promises a thrilling journey through a world where darkness and glamour collide. So get your Ouija board out, dim the lights, and join us in the Rock is Lit crypt for this special Halloween in March episode with Stacey Lane Wilson. Welcome to the podcast, Stacey.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm thrilled you're here. You have such a massive oeuvre. It makes my head spin. All the books that you've published. I mean, you've published over 20 books and counting. 10 in the Rock and Roll Nightmare series, that's fiction and nonfiction. 4 in the Immortal Confession series. 2 in the Sex, Death, Rock and Roll short story series. A short stories book and a novel that are horror books. 4 movie guides books. Then there's your memoir, So LA, a Hollywood memoir. And your mom, Nancy Bacon's memoir, which you edited, Legends and Lipstick. You've also produced, co-written, and directed several short horror films. And you wrote, produced, and directed a terrific full-length documentary on your dad, Don Wilson's legendary band, The Ventures, called The Ventures Stars on Guitars. So my first question is, when the hell do you sleep?
That's well, I could be a vampire. You never know. Actually, I do get a good 8 hours a night sleep. I just am very productive when I am working. So once I sit down and start working, then I am able to get an awful lot done in a short amount of time. I think I can thank my journalistic background for that, having to work on deadlines.
Well, that's that industrious Virgo in you, I guess.
This is true.
There is just no way to cover all of your work in this episode in any meaningful way, so we're going to focus on the fourth novel in the Immortal Confessions vampire series, Rhapsody in Red. Then we'll circle back and talk about your upbringing in Los Angeles in the 70s and 80s, and whatever else we have time to gab about.
All right.
So, Rhapsody in Red. Tell us a little about the series in general and this book in particular.
The Immortal Confession series combines things that I love, the paranormal, Hollywood, classic rock. So it has all of those elements to it. And being a series that's traditionally called paranormal romance, but they're not really traditional romances. They're more heavy on the mystery and the music and the things that I really love. Book 4 is a standalone, so it can be read independent of the other books, which I think makes it a fun Halloween read. So, for instance, if someone wants to pick that one up and read it in October when they're all in the Halloween spirit, they can without being lost.
That's when you sent it to me. It was right around Halloween.
Oh, nice. Did you read it then?
I thumbed through, but I didn't read it until last week, I think. But flipping through, I thought, oh, this is just going to be so much fun. And it was.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's like this vampire entertainment power couple in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very fun read. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, they're fun to write too, which I think is half the battle as a writer. I like to enjoy what I'm writing, and I write things that I myself would like to read. So I've really had fun with all the series that I'm a part of.
Well, before we go any further into Rhapsody in Red, let's give folks a little teaser. Here's an excerpt from the novel read by Stacy. Now, this is not the first chapter, so do you want to add any context to orient listeners?
So, Liam Archer is one half of the vampiric power couple. He's the lead singer of a band, Darkside. And in this excerpt that we're about to hear, he is set to debut his new single on KPDX in Paradox, New Mexico, a little radio station out in the middle of nowhere. As part of the fanfare, he's taking on the graveyard shift as a DJ, which is a good thing since he is a vampire. It's Halloween night, as you mentioned, 1978, a great year in music. So the listeners are invited to call in with their scariest stories. But little Deliant and the station's DJs know that they are about to be faced with a scary story of their own when a hook-handed killer breaks into the radio station and hunts them down one by one. So in the section we're about to hear, Liam has just arrived at the radio station and meets his co-host, the sexy night shift DJ, Loretta Lefevre.
All right, everybody, enjoy this excerpt from Rhapsody in Red. Then stick around for more of my interview with Stacy Lane Wilson.
No sooner had Paco disappeared than Loretta appeared. "Hi," she said huskily, Her voice was liquid sugar on sandpaper, hence her nickname, the Golden Throat. I'm Loretta. Liam stood as he always did when a lady entered the room. I'm Liam. Duh, she laughed. I've only been wearing the grooves off your records for the past 7 years. I bought the single A Butterfly Kiss with my babysitting money when I was 16. So, she was young, about 23, but there was something world-weary about her expression, indicating that she was wise beyond her years. Her eyes were most unusual. One was milk chocolate brown, and the other was the blue of lapis lazuli. Her hair was a deep, glossy black. Liam sat and Loretta took the chair opposite his, facing him from the other side of the desk. She wore a sheer gold, very low-cut wraparound dress, no bra or panties, silver spike heels, and a crown of red flames fashioned from what looked to be like mylar. Around her neck was a thin silver chain with a mirror ball pendant perched between her pert, ample breasts. Like it? She asked, batting her long false eyelashes. Do I like what? That was a loaded question if he'd ever heard one. Loretta's dress was so short he'd become an honorary gynecologist when she sat down. My costume, she tittered. Mortals could be so transparent, so needy, but he had to admit she was rather attractive. Forgive me, but who are you supposed to be? She put her hands to her circlet of fake fire. Disco Inferno! Then she shimmied so the mirror ball jiggled, along with other things. Of course, clever, Liam nodded. He changed the subject. As cute a morsel as she was, Liam had eyes only for one female these days. So I was just about to go over Paco's notes for the show, he said. She sighed disappointedly. Okay, okay, work, work, work. Loretta repeated much of what Paco had said about the songs that were both playlist friendly and Halloween themed. Such as the old staple Monster Mash, the new hit Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon, and the instrumental Frankenstein by the Edgar Winter Group, and that they would be encouraging listeners to call in with their favorite tales of terror, preferably true ones. Of course, they'll lie their asses off, Loretta speculated. And in case there are duds, we've got the local theater troupe set up to call in with some scripted stories. Naturally, we'll be saying that they're listeners. Nothing wrong with leaving nothing to chance, Liam said agreeably. It could be fun, like what Orson Welles did with his War of the Worlds broadcast. Loretta's eyes went blank. Who? Oh, never mind. I guess what I'm trying to say is it'll be fun and I'll do my best to keep up. Cool. And I can't wait to debut your new song. I'm so excited, but I have been a good girl. She gave him a sly look. I know, hard to believe, but I have. I wanted to wait until you were here. Listening to it with you will be such a thrill. Well, thanks, Liam smiled. Urban Legends was Darkside's fourth album, and Liam thought their best. His bandmates, three American mortals with no clue of Liam's true nature, had been more collaborative than ever this time around. When Darkside had burst onto the rock scene in 1971 with their first album and their number one single, Butterfly Kiss, there was passion but little discipline. After a few tours and endless writing and jam sessions, the kids were becoming bona fide, truly serious musicians. Liam thought of them as his children in a way, which is why he was here. He, of course, took pride in his work and wanted to create music that would inspire and spark, but he didn't need the recognition or financial reward like they did. Liam only wished that he wasn't the frontman. He felt that Tara, Buck, and Joel would be here with him. But their label, Brown Horse, had refused the request. Instead, they sent the band to play a Halloween show at the Troubadour with Tara taking over the vocals. Paco popped into the doorway. Okay, it's go time. Liam followed Paco's bouncing pom-poms and Loretta's bouncing body to the booth. Aside from some cheesy seasonal decorations, the DJ's inner sanctum was the same as ever, cluttered but cozy. Carpeted in green shag and paneled with nicotine-stained wood, dimly lit and smelling of incense and brewed coffee, the chamber was like a music-filled womb. Liam noticed they had tacked a new publicity photo of Darkside to the far wall. The band was sandwiched between Farrah Fawcett Majors grinning in her red one-piece bathing suit,
and a naked Frank Zappa sitting on a toilet. Jim Morrison was there too, in his famous Christ on the Cross pose, and so were Debbie Harry and Betty Page, blonde and brunette, respectively, and both hotter than hell. Liam had spent some time with Betty back in the 50s, and he wondered what she was up to now. She had to be past her prime, he thought. It was sad to him how mortals treasured youth above all else. There were two turntables, a reel-to-reel, an 8-track, three cassette machines, stacks of LPs, 45s, 78s, 12-inch promos, shelves, papers, and of course, the huge supra-aural headphones that he and Loretta would be wearing. Two mics hung from the ceiling from rigid but jointed steel apparatuses, and there were a couple of squeak-free chairs facing the console. Beyond the console was a large pane of glass, an indoor window that separated the DJs from the producer but kept them in visual contact. The previous DJ had already clocked out, and the end by the doors was spinning. With 10 minutes to go in the song, Liam would have plenty of time to get settled and acclimated before he went live, so to speak. Beside the record player were stacks of magazines like Cream, Rolling Stone, Penthouse, Circus, High Times, and Mad. Next to the magazines was a large tray filled with butts and roaches, and beside that was a full bottle of Jack Daniels along with the requisite stack of unused white styrofoam cups. Loretta took her seat. Liam followed suit and spread his papers out before him for easy reference. There wasn't much to remember, really. Standard stuff, a couple of talking points from his record label, a few jokes Paco had suggested in case there was any unexpected dead air, and the list of Halloween songs. Liam had also jotted down some bits of trivia he wanted to bring up, but other than that, the show was unscripted and would be relying heavily on listeners calling in with their scary stories. It was all pretty push-button. Morrison was singing about the killer who awoke before dawn now, about 5 minutes to go. Thunder crashed from the record. Or was it the storm still raging outside? Liam hoped that Ashara was indoors and embarking on her night of fun. She hadn't been anywhere festive since Francesca's birth. Of course, to their kind, the years passed as weeks. But still, it was beyond time to cut loose and enjoy a bit of fun. He was thinking he would like to take his wife and daughter to Monte Carlo for New Year's Eve. "Okay, guys," Paco said. "I'm going to leave you to it. Have a great show." He left the booth. Loretta scooted her chair closer to Liam's. "First, Paco will play the intro bumper, and then I'll do the station identification. Next up, I'll give a rundown of the show, and then I'll introduce you. You'll reply however you want, and then we'll ask listeners to call in. We'll segue into Sweet Transvestite from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and then, hopefully, there will be some good calls to choose from. Paco will screen them first, of course." "Got it," Liam nodded. The end was nearing its end now, where the haunting, chaotic, frenzied bridge would lead back to the vocals and climax. Loretta wriggled into her seat, situating herself. She pulled her mic closer to her, then gave Liam a smile. "Party time," she purred. Paco was now seated across from them behind the window. He, too, had his cans on and was giving them hand signals to a countdown. 3, 2, 1, point. A cart played the specially edited intro, which was an audio montage of lines from old horror movies, werewolf howls, screams, evil laughter, and eerie organ music. "And now," said a deep male voice that Liam swore was that of Vincent Price, "here is the KPDX Scream Team for your listening pleasure." "That's right, baby. It's me, the Golden Throat, Loretta LeFever, and the sexy, spooky singer from your favorite band and mine, Darkside, Liam Arch. We are coming," he emphasized the word, "at you live for 4 hours from 50,000 watts of clear channel radio, KPDX 108 on the dial, 1 hour to midnight on the dot, Southwestern Atlas time, baby." She paused briefly. "Liam, why don't you say good evening to our listeners and give them a taste of what's taken?" "Well, you are, Loretta," Liam said, leaning into his British accent for effect. The American fans loved it. Mates, you should see this vision of Halloween beauty. Loretta is an undead disco queen. Yes, disco is dead. You heard it here first. And she's like Jell-O in a G-string. And I'm not talking about the string on my guitar. Oh yes, I forgot, didn't I? I am indeed Liam Archer, here in the flesh, in gorgeous New Mexico. Thanks for having me on KPDX, the station that rocks Paradox. We have quite a show for you, and I do believe that sometime during the witching hour, we will be debuting the upcoming single from Darkside. Stay tuned, because you do not want to miss it. And, Loretta continued, we want to hear from you. Call in with your favorite scary stories. True stories, if you've got them. Urban legends. She looked at Liam. Urban Legends is the name of Darkside's album, out on November 18th. So, she continued, we want to hear from you. Call in now. Producer Paco is waiting to take your calls. In the meantime, listen to this oldie but goodie from Sugar Pie DeSanto, Witch for a Night.
I'm gonna be a party popping, show stopping, wig flopping, witch for a night. My rent is overdue.
Hey, this is Mac B the Wolf.
And this is Action Jackson from the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast.
And you are listening to Rock is Lit with our rock and roll sister, Christy Alexander Hallberg.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
We're back with Stacey Lane Wilson, author of many, many books, but you just heard an excerpt from her novel Rhapsody in Red, the featured book in this episode. Now, as you were saying before the reading started, the novel is set in 1978, primarily on Halloween night, 1978. Other than the fact that the movie Halloween was released in late October 1978, was there any significance to your choosing that year to set the story?
I think it was just such a great year in music, and it's just on the cusp of the 80s, which is another part of a different book in the series. So I feel just like it's a great kind of jumping off point for both characters to kind of set them on their next path. Also, it's just, well, Halloween is my favorite holiday.
Mine too, girl. Mine too.
Yeah, so there's just so many different interesting myths and legends that surround Halloween. That's what I love about it. It's a rich sort of breeding ground for ideas and fun. And I also enjoy a good Agatha Christie style locked room mystery. So I was able to combine those two elements by putting Liam in one scenario and then his wife, Ashara, in the other.
Now, I know you love history, so I can appreciate the attention to historical detail in this book. For example, you mentioned the new moon, and because I'm a nerd, I had to go look that up and make sure you got that right.
Okay, did I?
You got it right. On Halloween night, 1978, it was a new moon. Do you get into doing that kind of nitpicky research?
Well, yes, I do, actually. Like yourself, there are certain things that we're nerdy about. So for me, it's horses, because I grew up riding horses and showing horses and training horses. So I know everything about the breeds, where they come from, the parts of the bridle, the saddle. And so a lot of times people will throw horses into particularly romance novels. And some of the things they get wrong are pretty hilarious. So I always try to make sure that I have things correct. For instance, one of the characters in the Immortal Confessions vampire series is a practitioner of voodoo. So that is not something that I know a lot about, although I'm quite intrigued by it. So I did a lot of research when writing anything to do with her character to make sure that it rang true, but was still also fun and scary and part of the fantasy element of the books.
Speaking of voodoo, New Orleans plays a role in this book. Marie LeVay gets a shout out.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a little mention of voodoo in here. But another example of your nailing historical context, Ashara was 21 in 1814 when she died or became undead.
Mm-hmm.
You write that she was a student of Beethoven's before her death, and she is born in Vienna, Austria. In February 1814, Beethoven's Eighth Symphony premiered. So there's just all these little things that I was looking up and going, all right, she nailed that one. This is cool.
I appreciate that because you are a teacher, so I know you're double checking.
Well, I'm a nerd more than a teacher, I think. We know that Ashara and Lim are vampires. Now, I'm not an aficionado on vampires, other than the garlic and stake through the heart thing. So give me a vampire 101 course. For instance, Lim is a chosen one vampire. Tell me a little bit about what that is. And is this generally accepted vampire lore, or did you make it up?
Oh, this is something that I made up going back to biblical times. So the people who made him were apostles, and they drank from the blood of Christ. And of course, we know Christ is sort of a zombie, I guess you could say. Came back to life, according to the Bible. I added that in just to give it more historical context and more sort of pithy content. So that was something that I made up, although I did see something about that in another vampire book a long, long time ago, but I can't remember exactly what that story was. So I just kind of pivoted off of that and made up something new. And it is fun to come up with new mythology, although there's really no such thing as new, but there are twists.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in my teens and 20s, I loved Anne Rice's vampire, witch, and mummy books, and I read all of them, maybe, you know, even more than once. And I'm also a fan of Bram Stoker's original Dracula book.
Yes.
Which is really beautifully written. I don't think enough people really have the gumption to go back and read it because they may feel that it's dated or has very stiff, archaic language, but it's really quite lovely to read. So that's another favorite. But then, of course, I also love classic rock and vintage Hollywood and the Laurel Canyon setting with its rich musical history and lore. So I wanted to intertwine all of those elements to create something completely different and yet familiar at the same time.
And all those things come together so well. Urban Legends is the name of Lim's band Darkside's new album. Now, there's a lot about urban legends in this story. Loretta, the radio DJ with whom Lim is guest hosting a Halloween night radio show, as you said earlier, asked listeners to call in with their own true stories and urban legends. Here are some of the urban legends that are mentioned in the novel. We have a caller talking about a New Mexican evil entity known as La Mala Hora. Hora?
Hey, I only write them. I don't say them. I'm not sure.
Here's the thing, because I'd never heard of this. I looked it up, though, and it is a real urban legend.
It is.
If you see it at a crossroads, you or someone in your family will die. And then there's the tale of a prostitute's body stashed under the bed for days at a seedy motel. Hadn't heard of that one either. This one I had heard of, Bloody Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You see her in the bathroom mirror. And then I think most of us around our age remember the urban legend about getting a severed finger in your drive-through French fry order.
Oh, yeah.
Were these stories you heard as a kid?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so much fun to tell at slumber parties with all my girlfriends scaring each other so we didn't sleep all night long, and my mom coming out of her room to yell at us, go to bed, go to sleep. So it was just such a fun part of growing up. And I feel like that sort of campfire storytelling is a bit lost now. And it just kind of brought back a lot of fun memories as I was writing this book and coming up with my favorite stories. I think The Hook-Handed Killer was always my favorite, so that's why I gave that one more of a center stage in this book.
Now, the one that immediately comes to mind, it's not mentioned in the book, if I'm remembering correctly, it's the one about the babysitter on acid putting a ham or a turkey to bed and cooking the baby.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard that one?
Yes, I do. I have heard of that one, or the poodle or the cat or whatever it might have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard that a lot right before I started babysitting, so that was most disturbing.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't take any acid before you babysat.
Well, I tried to refrain. I did.
Okay, good.
Dead babies can't take care of themselves. Dead babies can take things off the shelf.
It'll be interesting to see what time period Lim and Ashara find themselves in the next installment, should there be one. But right now, you and I are going to time travel back to your childhood and young adulthood. So here's a little bit of trivia. Rhapsody in Red is primarily set on a Tuesday, which Halloween night in 1978 was a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
You were also born on a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
It was August 23rd in the mid-60s. Now, Rick Springfield was also born on August 23, totally different year, way, way earlier than you. And that was also a Tuesday, so you guys might have a little juju going on.
Wow, I did not know that. Yeah, actually, I met him at a barbecue once, just at random. I had no idea he was going to be there. And it was just after, I want to say like days or maybe just a week after I finished reading his autobiography. So it was really weird kind of synchronicity, I guess.
Yeah.
That I would happen to run into him randomly at a barbecue shortly after I finished reading his book, which was a lot about his sex addiction. So like when I met him and I said, oh, I liked your book. And then I'm thinking to myself, maybe there was another way I could have worded that.
Oh, dear.
Awkward.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
He was nice.
Let's talk about your parents. I know they split up when you were basically a toddler, and you were primarily raised by your mom, the pinup model, actress, and writer Nancy Bacon. But I gather you saw your dad, Don Wilson, as often as possible, given his crazy touring schedule with The Ventures. And we'll get to your dad and the documentary on The Ventures you wrote, produced, and directed. But first, I think your mother is so fascinating. Tell me about her. Because she was quite the free spirit and Hollywood hobnobber in her day.
Yeah, no kidding. She deserves a documentary of her own as well.
I was going to ask you. I mean, she's not really mentioned in the Ventures documentary. I was wondering if you're going to do one on her.
I've thought about it. I'm not sure, like, how litigious society might be, because her stories are not all happy sunshine and rainbow stories about some of these celebrities. However, most of them have passed away, so who knows? I guess it's a toss-up. But I always just thought that focusing on her and her life, just the path that she took, and she was so courageous and wild, like is a bit of a wild child. She ran away from home at the age of 13 from Ellensburg, Washington, which is known for its rodeos and cows. And she wanted more for herself. She was the youngest of 9 children.
Yowza.
Yeah, like 13 years old, she dropped out of school and went to the nearest road, stuck her thumb out, and got a ride to, Las Vegas. She got a job as a showgirl with a fake ID. And then she made her way to Hollywood and became sort of a ghostwriter because she was so young, but she was writing a column under a man's name who was her boyfriend at the time. A gossip column. So she was really in the thick of it. And back then, in those days, it was so easy to do those things like that, get a fake ID and pretend you're older and rent an apartment and buy a car. And, you know, under the age of 18, she did so much in that point. And it was such an incredibly rich time in history that she sort of was on the fringes of that. She was one of the many, many, many ladies to date Jay Sebring, the hairdresser who was murdered in the Manson family massacres. So she knew him, and she knew Jane Mansfield and Marilyn Monroe, and she had a fling with Bobby Kennedy. I mean, so many things that she did are just fascinating. And then she was a pinup model, like you said, but she was always extremely intelligent, even though she never finished school. She was highly self-educated.
Mm-hmm.
That was her goal, always to be a writer. So she started off doing gossip columns and then essays in magazines, true crime reporting. She was the second female editor of Confidential magazine in the early 1970s. She was just really a very, very interesting lady.
Let's talk more about the Manson family. Now, I know, like me, you've been enthralled with that case since you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was just in LA this past April and did an all-day tour of major Manson sites.
Oh, wow.
And one of the places was where Spahn Ranch used to be, which is out there at Chatsworth. Now, didn't you live in Chatsworth for a while when you were a kid?
I did, yeah. I don't think I ever went to Spahn Ranch, but part of the fascination, of course, was hearing my mom's stories about it growing up.
Yeah.
But also seeing the TV miniseries starring Steve Rails back as Charles Manson as a kid. I mean,
yes,
right?
Yes, ma'am.
And reading the book.
Yeah.
So all those things, I think, infused a lot of us Gen Xers. It still is a case that fascinates, though, because there's no shortage of new movies and true crime documentaries featuring Charlie Manson. I mean, he's just like the ultimate pop culture boogeyman.
It's such a rock and roll crime.
Sure.
Music was at the heart of that family. Charlie wanted to be a rock musician, and the Beatles music was important. There are so many elements to that case that make it fascinating for people like you and me who are music fans and pop culture fans. And I'm interested in Hollywood and in old Hollywood. I grew up watching old movies with my mother on black and white TV. And so I was immersed in that kind of pop culture from a very young age.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, we both were.
Your mother, so you helped her with her memoir, Legends and Lipstick, because by that time she had had a stroke and couldn't type anymore.
Right.
I love that your mother had wild cats at the house.
Right. Well,
that is amazing.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she was kind of like Tippi Hedren. She also had lions and things growing up, but fortunately, none of us got attacked, unlike Melanie Griffith. I believe she was attacked by a lion or something when she was a kid,
oh,
making
dear.
That movie Roar. Yeah, I haven't seen that movie, but I've heard it's pretty wild. But yeah, my mom, she actually loved ocelots, the little smaller, I think they're South American wild cats. But she also took care of cheetahs, lions, and cougars. She used to do part-time work for Ralph Heffler. I think that was his name.
Hmm.
He was a movie animal trainer, so she took care of Zamba. He was a lion in a lot of Disney movies, and Sir Tom, who was in a Disney movie called The Cat, and the cheetah, Jate. I believe he was just used for photo shoots, but I've got all kinds of great pictures of my mom with all these big cats.
Oh, wow.
She's giving them big hugs and kisses. She loved animals. I had so many animals as a kid growing up. It was like a zoo in our backyard.
It's so interesting that she had these wild cats and you have rats. So we have the predator and the prey.
Right. Well, never together. Never together. Yeah, I think, you know, when I was a kid, that kind of the big cats went away because obviously, well, hopefully she wanted to protect me. She liked me better than she liked the big cats. But yeah, it was hard for her though, because she's a like super, super cat lady. That was her whole thing. When I was growing up, of course, in the 70s, not many people spayed or neutered. So there were always like 10 cats running around our house.
Wow.
At least. Yeah. But I think it's also great for a kid to see kittens being born and raising kittens. And I just think it teaches you a lot about life to have animals around when you're young.
black cats and witch hats and jack-o'-lanterns twinkling. Spooky ghosts and black bats got my spine tingling. Witches round the cauldron, stirring through this bright green. I just can't wait for Halloween. Do you hear autumn?
Tell me more about your girls, your rat girls, Danielle and Dominique, named after the sisters in the Brian De Palma film Sisters.
They are, but they're lovely, sweet little creatures. They're nothing out of a horror movie. Yeah. Well, I do Ratter Day on social media.
I know.
Every week. So yes, people look forward to that. And I think that was actually pretty smart on my part that I don't post pictures of them every day because people get excited about Ratter Day to see what the rats are up to this week. So it's fun. They're just such precious, sweet, smart, great pets. A lot of people who have been afraid of rats or weren't sure about rats, and they come over and they snuggle with mine and they change their minds about rats because they really do get a bad rap. They're fantastic little pets and very clean. They're always grooming themselves like cats do.
Mm.
They're like a cat or a dog. You know, when you come home from being out, they'll be like standing right at the door of their cage with their little paws up like, hello, we missed you.
Oh, I may have to rethink the rat pet thing.
They are precious. You'll have to come and visit me in Las Vegas and I'll introduce you to the rats.
I would love it. It's a date.
Okay.
So I emailed you last night and told you I was rewatching The Venture Stars on Guitars, the documentary that you wrote, produced, directed. It is such a great tribute and testament to the impact The Ventures had on pop culture and the music of the 60s and 70s and on and on. When did you decide to do the film?
Well, The Ventures started in 1959, as you know, from watching the doc. But yeah, they were around for decades and had so many gold records, platinum records, accolades, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But there had never, ever been a documentary made about them. And on occasion, some wannabe producers would approach my dad or the Ventures manager and say, oh, we'd like to make a documentary on the Ventures. But they never came through. I guess that's just part of the flakiness of the filmmaking business. But still, it was surprising. And since I had made a couple of narrative films, my brother, Tim, suggested that I take it on. And I thought, well, hey, why not? You know, how hard can it be? Well, it's not the same as making a movie with a script and actors. A documentary is such a fluid thing with so many different moving parts, not to mention legal red tape with song rights and getting releases from all the famous people in the movie that are in it. So yeah, it was very difficult to do, but I did accomplish it in about 3 years, which I understand is a pretty quick time in documentary world.
Mm.
And fortunately, my dad got to see it before he passed away, and he loved it. He was really proud of me and what I did, and that makes me feel good. I mean, he's really the main critic that I want to please, and he loved it. And I've just been getting nothing but really super feedback from fans and lovers of the Ventures and lovers of music who maybe didn't know who the Ventures were, but then realized what kind of impact they had on the bands that they loved, which is what I wanted to do when I set out to make it, was to show just how cyclical music can be and how even if I love Anthrax, say, and then you realize, oh man, Anthrax was influenced by the Ventures. Mm-hmm. In fact, they even thanked the Ventures in the liner notes of one of their albums. So groups that really don't sound anything like the Ventures still give a nod to the Ventures for getting them interested in playing, especially guitar-driven music.
Absolutely. I mean, you had Jimmy Page in the documentary.
I do, yes. That was a massive cheer on my end. I was like, I love Jimmy Page so much. And then when I found out that he had learned how to play guitar with the Ventures, I mean, I knew this before the documentary, but yeah, it was just like such a revelation to me because Jimmy Page is my hero.
Yes, I think you and I are related in some way.
You think?
And you know, I'm one of these people who was familiar with the Ventures before I saw this. This was not like, oh, who's that group?
Uh-huh.
And I told you before when we talked on your podcast, the Ventures Christmas album is my all-time favorite Christmas album. I heard that incessantly when I was growing up during the holidays. It's a fabulous, fabulous album.
It is, yeah. They actually have two different Christmas albums, but I think what I love most about it is the fact that it's got the Ventures guitar sound, their very unique sound, and then it blends into traditional Christmas music, but with guitars. And there's no vocals, which just makes it so nice to have on in the background. Sometimes Christmas music can be a little annoying to me.
Yeah.
But the Ventures never are, because it's all instrumental.
One of the things that I most enjoyed about the documentary was learning about your grandmother, your father's mother, Josie, who was instrumental in launching the Ventures in a way. I mean, she came up with the name. She suggested the group's name. She supported them in the early days, produced them in the early days, and she even wrote one of the early songs. I think it was Cookies and Coke.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I thought to myself as I was rewatching it, you know, I was flashing on your mother too, and I thought, Stacey's been surrounded by some strong, smart, creative women in her life.
Yes.
And how wonderful.
Yeah, really has been such a great influence, even when it's subconscious, you're unconscious, you don't really realize that these values and drive and creativity is kind of seeping into you day by day just by being surrounded with it. You know, at times I had a very difficult childhood because my mom was an alcoholic and she went through cancer at a very young age, had to have a radical double mastectomy. So, I mean, childhood wasn't all fun and simple, but I think that
right.
also builds character and just makes you want to succeed that much more.
What was your relationship like with your grandmother, your dad's mom?
Oh, it was great. She lived in Washington and we lived in Los Angeles, so I didn't get to see her all the time, but whenever I did, she was just so much fun to be around. She had great stories, very supportive. She would read all my little handwritten, stapled together books that I would write as a little kid
Aww.
About horses and you know, she'd be very encouraging. She was a great influence on my life. And just the fact that she was so supportive of the Ventures, like you mentioned, she was one of the first female record producers. And not only that, I mean, she was divorced and she was in her 40s and she was a grandmother already at that time because she got married, I think, when she was 14 or something. And her first child was born when she was 16. So life got started much earlier back then. But when you think about ageism and sexism in the late 50s and 60s, when she was doing what she was doing to get the Ventures going as a record producer, it's pretty amazing and very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. And that band was huge in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
My podcast production intern this semester, Cater Jones, can attest to this. He did a study abroad trip to Japan last May. And when I told him I was interviewing you and that your dad was a founding member of the Ventures, he was like, oh, they love the Ventures in Japan.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, being an instrumental band really helps because there's no language barrier and it's just such feel good music that just a lot of people are very inspired by it. And it stirs the soul when you hear the Ventures because there's really no sound quite like them.
Mm-mm.
They're pretty unique. The guitar sound of the Ventures is pretty different.
Here is probably the biggest instrumental record of the day, a thing called Walk, Don't Run. Ladies and gentlemen, here are the Ventures.
Stacey, about being Don Wilson's daughter and being backstage. I'm assuming you went to some Venture shows,
oh, yeah.
being backstage at some shows and experiencing the adulation of the crowd and meeting celebrities. What was that like for you as his child?
Well, I think as a child, you take things for granted. And even to the point of where your parents are very uncool. So for me, it's like, the Ventures, you know, I was really into Led Zeppelin and The Who and the Rolling Stones and all that, and didn't really understand at that young age how the Ventures sort of paved the way for the bands that I was enjoying at the time. So that would be my experience as a kid, but it certainly, in retrospect, was really such a wonderful experience for me to be able to see that other side of life from backstage, or to travel to Japan. My dad took me to Japan to some ventures tours. And so I got to witness that, which was really, I think that really drove home the aspect of the adulation that the ventures received, because the last time me and my siblings were there for the final tour, 2015. And even at that far into their career, there were fans lined up in the rain outside waiting for the band to come out afterwards. And the ventures were always so accommodating and appreciative of their fans that they stayed and signed every single autograph. To think that even at that late stage in their career, just, you know, 9 years ago, I can only imagine what it must have been like in the 60s and early 70s. Pandemonium.
Your dad comes across in the film is so affable and friendly and approachable. Was he that way off camera, off stage as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, he sure was. Yeah, he was just such a friendly, kind, nice guy that he never met a stranger, basically. So, yeah. So that's all genuine.
Switching gears just a little bit here, going from somebody who's apparently got a very sunny personality to, I've read that you've always had a fascination with the, quote, dark side.
This is true. Yes.
Both of your parents dug horror films. Your mom showed you The Exorcist when you were a little kid. You know, I saw The Exorcist when I was a little kid, too, and it messed with my head for many, many years.
I don't really get scared anymore, but when I was a kid, I actually enjoyed being scared, so I would kind of seek out horror movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fun for me, I guess, because when I was growing up, I always felt protected and safe, and I didn't really think that anything would ever really hurt me. But then there's also that other dark side of growing up, being a young kid in the 1970s in the San Fernando Valley when the Hillside Stranglers were active.
Yeah.
So there was that kind of underlying shadow hanging over everything. I mean, there was still the California sunshine and the riding my ponies and the fields and all that good stuff. But then there was kind of this other side to it, this flip side to it. And actually, a good friend of mine, one of my best friends when I was a kid, her cousin was murdered by the Hillside Stranglers.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that time, they thought there was only one. So it was the Hillside Strangler until they caught them and realized that it was two people. But I just feel like that does kind of worm its way into your psyche, you know?
Yeah.
Just growing up, you kind of absorb that through osmosis or whatever. So I think it does shape a person's mentality, especially I think like Gen X, you know, they say we were raised on hose water and neglect. So basically that's kind of what makes us very have this dark and cynical side. But then, you know,
I
think so. That's the hose water.
Damn. So also while you were a kid, you're reading Kenneth Anger's book, Hollywood Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Bedtime stories.
Yeah. And you know, it's not difficult to see why you would be drawn to bands like Led Zeppelin, just as I was. Myth and lore, light and dark, rumors of Jimmy Page's dabblings in the occult abound. And like me, you had Led Zepp posters on your bedroom walls.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when that band first took hold of you?
Honestly, I wish I could say I was so cool that I knew exactly what Led Zeppelin was all about. And I was, you know, I knew all about Led Zeppelin before anyone else did. But actually, it was because a boy that I had a crush on was into Led Zeppelin. So the boy didn't last, but Led Zeppelin did. So I think I got the better end of the deal on that one, actually.
I think you did.
Yeah.
What did your dad think of Led Zeppelin? Do you know?
Well, the Ventures did do a cover of Whole Lotta Love.
I didn't know that. Wow.
It did, yeah, in the early 70s. But, you know, he was not a fan, to be honest. He really wasn't into the British invasion rock. He was really more of an Americana country and jazz fan.
Right. Sadly, as I just learned in reading your book, Rock and Roll Nightmares, True Stories, Volume 1, Your dad has something tragic in common with Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin, whose five-year-old son Carrick died of a stomach virus while Robert was on tour with the band in 1977. Your dad lost his five-year-old son from his first marriage to a horseback riding accident at summer camp in August 1966, like weeks before you were born, and he was on tour in Japan at the time. My God, how horrific.
Yes, really. I mean, we didn't really talk about my brother Kelly much growing up.
Yeah.
But also, it's kind of like almost like two different families until my siblings and I were adults, because they grew up with their mom in Washington State, and I grew up with my mom in LA. Of course, we saw each other maybe once or twice a year, but it was like being an only child. I didn't really experience that tragedy, of course, because I wasn't even born yet when he passed away, but my dad never really talked about it that much. His generation, you know, didn't often talk about problems and troubles, and, you know, he kind of shed a tear and keep on working. So that was the generation he was from. But yeah, I mean, it was very cataclysmic for his mother and for my half siblings who were his full sibling. It was a terrible, tragic accident at summer camp. Young instructors, who I guess were teenagers working at this camp, tied Kelly to the saddle of the horse, and then the cinch wasn't tight enough, and the horse got spooked and ran off, and the saddle turned underneath the horse's stomach with the little child tied to the saddle, so he couldn't even fall off. Ugh. So he was unfortunately trampled. And yeah, it's a really awful story. And of course, being on tour, getting that phone call, I mean, I can't even imagine. And being as far away as you can possibly be from the U.S. and Japan, you know, such a like 17-hour flight.
When I read that, I'm flashing on you many years later, getting horses, getting ponies. I couldn't help but wonder, did he have any reservations about you riding?
He didn't like it at first, but then he realized that it was more than just a temporary passing fancy to me. I was really, truly horse crazy as a kid. And fortunately, where we were living, we could have horses in the backyard. It was zoned for horses in Chatsworth back then. So yeah, my mom got me my first pony, and he was evil. We called him Al Capone. But I loved horses so much that I persevered, and I just never gave up until I was finally able to get a really great pony that took care of me and taught me how to ride. Basically, this pony was like, if I would start to fall off, he would shift so that I could stay on him. And he was just a really neat pony. And then I got several horses after that, and I actually had a career raising and training horses for many years until I got into becoming a film critic and a red carpet reporter, and just did not have time to maintain both things and gave up horses. But yeah, it was just something that was definitely in my blood. I don't know. It's just such a strange thing, though. You're right. For my dad to have lost one child to a horse riding accident, and then the next child is born a couple of weeks later and a few years later wants a horse.
She comes down from Yellow Mountain on a dark flatland she rides, on a pony she named Wildfire, a whirlwind by her side on a cold Nebraska night.
Hi everyone, this is Neil Preston, and you are listening to Rock is Lit. I'm not, but rock is.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Your interest in horses kind of launched your riding career in a way, because you sold your first article about a pony you trained and raised to a national magazine when you were 12 years old. And it was a paying gig.
Yeah, that was a big thing back then. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I actually had to write a story, type it out on a typewriter, mail it in to the editor of the magazine and wait to hear back. And that was what launched my career, yes.
And you mentioned your freelance entertainment reporting career. So how did that come about?
I started in 2001, I want to say. I just always loved writing, I want to clarify, horror movies, horror books. So I just was trying to find a way to combine those things. And I had one book published in the late 90s of short horror stories. And I was searching around to see who I could, you know, websites that might review it or something. And I reached out to a site called horror.com. And the editor wrote back and said, oh, I really liked your book. And have you ever thought about like writing movie reviews? Because I'm looking for somebody. So that's kind of how it started. And I lived in not far from Hollywood at the time, where all the press screenings and red carpets and junkets were. So I was in the right place at the right time and had an assignment by a legitimate website to start covering horror movies. And then that snowballed into many other genres and a full-time career for probably 15 years or so.
Well, your mom used to edit Confidential, a tabloid magazine, so you're no stranger to Hollywood gossip.
Right.
So start dishing. I want to know, who was the most difficult celebrity you interviewed?
Well, there's a couple. Not that many, though, thankfully. I mean, I have heard bad stories about people like, oh my gosh, you know, was it Samuel L. Jackson? I remember people told me, oh man, he's really tough. He's a tough crowd. But every time I interviewed him, he was awesome. So you just never know. But the least favorite people for me, Liam Neeson was definitely.
I knew you were going to say that.
Never friendly. The worst, though, was probably Glenn Danzig, who just was horrible. He actually kicked me out of his house.
Oh my God.
I know, right? I was asking quote unquote the wrong questions. Although in most cases, I was able to craft my own questions because I'd been doing it for so many years, but I was on assignment for a magazine that the editor wanted me to ask his questions. So I had a list of questions that I had to go from. And Glenn was just absolutely horrible. But he started off horrible even before I asked my first question, which is certainly his reputation bears that out.
So we have two horrible ones. Yeah. Do you have a favorite or two?
One of my all-time favorites always was Robin Williams. He was just really genuinely funny. I want to say like he was always on. Yes, he was always on, at least when he was at a press event. But that's fine, because that's what you want. You want sound bites. You want someone who's going to be playful and give you a good interview. But he would also take notice of things. Like, for instance, one time when I was on a red carpet interviewing him, I was wearing a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. And so like, he noticed that. And then he made a joke about his Ethel Merman sings Led Zeppelin record. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. So I loved how like he wasn't just waiting for something funny to say. Like he wasn't pre-scripted. He would actually incorporate your questions and maybe what you were wearing into a joke, which I just thought was great. Keanu Reeves is also another person that I've interviewed a number of times and is always very nice. He's tuned in. He looks you in the eyes when he's answering a question. He's also doesn't seem pre-scripted or just like, oh, well, I'm here at this press junket on yet another assembly line and here's my spiel, you know, so that it is nice to meet actually very talented, genuine, good people to talk to.
Did anybody surprise you? You think, oh, I was expecting you to be, oh, I guess Samuel L. Jackson, but
that's
anybody
one
else that you were expecting to be one way and they were either better than you thought or worse than you thought?
Well, Brittany Murphy is one that comes to mind. She was surprising because she was extremely intellectual. I don't know why I wasn't expecting that, but she was very, very well read, very knowledgeable on music history. She was always a fun person to talk to. And after I talked to her a couple of times, she actually remembered my name. And so that was always good because because these celebrities are on red carpets all the time and they see a blur of faces and microphones. So for her to actually remember my name and address me by name after the first couple of interviews was special. And it was such a sad tragedy that she passed away at such a young age.
Yep.
Yeah. Overall, it really has been great being able to meet so many different creative people. I've always found that I prefer to interview directors, writers, musicians over, say, the A-list actors. Oh, that's fun too, though.
So, Stacey, you've got a killer podcast that you host called Rock and Roll Nightmares, which, as I said earlier, I've had the pleasure to be a guest on. The podcast is part of your Rock and Roll Nightmares series of both nonfiction and fiction books. How long have you been doing the podcast, and how do you see it complementing your books in this series?
Well, it's all part of building the brand. The podcast is something that is part of the Rock and Roll Nightmares world, mainly to bring attention to the books, which is why I started it, honestly, but also because I'm quite interested in people who love rock music, the dark side, and writing. So I have a lot of authors on my show, like yourself.
Yeah.
So I love that aspect of it. It's just because I enjoy meeting creative people and helping get the word out about what they're doing, because it's so hard to stand out these days. There's just so many
podcasts.
plethora of, yeah. So I think that having a podcast that kind of narrows it down to focus on those things has helped me out. I don't monetize it or anything. It's just something that I do because I love it and I want to help people and I want to kind of bring awareness to the Rock and Roll Nightmares books.
One of the books included in the Rock and Roll Nightmares series is called 28, and that was just published this past July, I believe. Mm-hmm. I gather this has to do in some way with the 27 Club, as in, what if the members of the 27 Club hadn't lived?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about 28.
Well, that's the premise, basically what you said. So I love a good what-if story. Speculative fiction is just one of my favorite things to write, or alternate history. So this is a collection that features a few stories by me, but also other authors who I handpicked to tell their stories, of Brian Jones and, let's see, Kurt Cobain, of course. Janis Joplin. Yes, there's a lot. I wrote the Jim Morrison story, and then I wrote the Amy Winehouse story. So it was just really fun to see what people would come up with. I really only gave them the person to write about and said, run with it. So it was cool to see what they did.
There's also a great chapter in your nonfiction book, Rock and Roll Nightmares, True Stories, Volume 1, about the 27 Club. So I think you should come back on Rock is Lit in Season 4 for a special episode devoted to the 27 Club.
That is a subject that I absolutely am fascinated by. I'd love to.
Me too. All right.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. We sweat and laugh and scream.
Now, we started the episode focusing on your novel, Rhapsody in Red. So let's wrap it up with that book. This game is called Only Pick One. You can only pick one from each category I'm going to throw out. And every category has to do with Rhapsody in Red. You ready?
I think so.
Okay, let's play the game. First category, Halloween songs DJ Loretta plays on the radio program. Some of the main action of the novel takes place on Halloween night, and Lem is visiting a radio station to promote his band Darkside's new album, Urban Legend. And throughout the night, he and the DJ play a slew of great Halloween rock songs. And this was so much fun for me. I counted 24 of them. I may be missing some, but here are six of them. Which is your favorite?
Okay.
Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. Frankenstein by the Edgar Winter Group. Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield. Welcome to My Nightmare by Alice Cooper. Sympathy for the Devil by the Stones, and Season of the Witch by Donovan.
Oh, that's tough. I love all those songs.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to have to go with Sympathy for the Devil.
Okay.
I like the historical context in the lyrics.
I think I would go with Tubular Bells because it scared the living shit out of me.
And The Exorcist, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, next category. Monsters who attended the murder mystery party. So there's a long list of monsters who attended that party.
That's right. They didn't all exit, though, did they?
No, they did not. They did not. I'm going to give you a choice of five, and you tell me which of those five you would have the most fun with at a party. Vampire, ghost, witch, werewolf, or zombie? Who would you most want to hang out with at a Halloween party?
Oh, a witch, definitely. We could play all kinds of parlor games.
Somehow I knew you would say that.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Ouija boards, palm reading.
It's got that Stevie Nicks vibe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. How about you?
I would have picked the witch, too.
Yeah.
Okay, next category, and I really like this one. Hotels with haunted past. Without giving anything away, there are three actual hotels that get a shout-out in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Something gruesome happened at all three. So, which one would you least like to find yourself locked in on a stormy Halloween night when the electricity is out? Here's the first one. The Murder Castle, otherwise known as the Chicago Hotel, where Henry Howard Holmes murdered at least 27 young women during the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. That's one. Chelsea Hotel, where Nancy Spungen was allegedly murdered by Sid Vicious in room 100 in 1978. Third, Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. There were lots of suicides and murders there through the decades. And the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, stayed in a room on the top floor for a while in the 80s. So which one would you least like to find yourself locked in on a stormy Halloween night when the electricity's out?
Well, I've already been to the Cecil Hotel, so.
Oh, you have?
Yes. So I am going to pick the Chelsea Hotel because at least before I was murdered, I might get to hear some cool music being played or meet some musicians. Maybe Leonard Cohen would be there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, after you're murdered, you'll probably meet some really cool people, too.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Murder Castle, I think, burned down, so you couldn't go there anyway. But here's the last category. Drinks mentioned in the book. It's a rock novel, for God's sake. We have to talk booze, and
that's
legally required.
Yes.
So here's a list of the drinks mentioned in Rhapsody in Red, and some of them are kind of fancy pants.
Mm-hmm.
I had to look up a couple of them, in fact. Which is your favorite? Here's one I had to look up. Anisette. This is Lem's favorite drink. It's an Argentina brand. I'm going to totally screw up the pronunciation. Liqueur de los Eight Hermanos, vintage 1950s. We have that. And then we have wine, thank God, at the Halloween party. Wine is available to the monster guests. And then we have a bottle of pure cacao liqueur at the Halloween party. And then champagne. Lem and Ashara offered champagne on the plane after her party and his radio station experience. And then Jack Daniels, DJ Loretta, is knocking back Jack at the radio station.
Just like Jimmy Page. Yeah.
There you go. There you go.
I'm going to go with champagne.
Okay.
How about you?
I'm a bit of a wino. I suspect that that would be my favorite of this offering.
Okay. Well, hey, let's not forget that yet another book in the Rock and Roll Nightmare series is Rock Tales, which is very many cocktail and mocktail recipes.
Yes.
For those rock stars who are on the wagon, we have mocktails too.
Well, Stacey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was so much fun.
It sure was. Thanks for having me. And I love your questions. And I'm really glad that you enjoyed the books.
I very much did. And I look forward to reading a lot more of your stuff.
Awesome. Well, there's always more coming. In fact, I'm excited to read your next book.
You'll be waiting a while for that one.
Oh, all right. Well, I got plenty to read in the meantime, but I'm very excited about that.
Oh. Catch Stacey's cool podcast, Rock and Roll Nightmares, wherever you stream your podcast. Learn more about the podcast and Stacey at these websites, rock-in-roll-nightmares.com and StaceyLaneWiltson.com, where you can also get links to her social media pages. Pick up her books, all gazillion of them, on Amazon or listen on Audible. What should folks be on the lookout from you in 2024?
Well, the next book that I'll be putting out is called Blood on the Tracks, and it's a nonfiction rock and roll nightmares book about the deaths behind the songs. So songs that were inspired by suicides, murders, the ones that kind of hit close to home and were written about friends or family members, or songs that take on broader topics like wars, school shootings, or serial killers like Jack the Ripper, Ted Bundy. So there's no shortage of songs inspired by horrible true events, and I'm drilling down on all of them in the next book.
Good times.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thanks again, Stacey.
All right. Thank you. Bye, Christy.
So strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch, yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, Lit listeners. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a rating and comment on Good Pods and Apple Podcasts. Links in the show notes. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I really appreciate your support. Until next time, keep rocking and reading and getting lit.
Rock is lit.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.